This is Fresh Air. Elizabeth Suedos is a successful avant-garde theater composer and writer. Her new book is a memoir about her family and mental illness. She's from an upper-middle-class family in Buffalo, New York, but her brother, Lincoln Suedos, ended up a schizophrenic street person in Manhattan. Before we talk, here's a reading from her book.
Most middle-class people ask themselves haunting questions about the homeless, the so-called Bowery bums, and crazy people who populate the streets of New York. We all get panhandled. Once in a while, we may be witness to a raspy, nonsensical speech about politics or God. We often walk past ragged creatures who sleep on gratings and whose urine trails into the street. The numbers of these people are growing. The middle-class person asks, how did these people get here? Who are they? Where are their families? How did they fall so low? We all harbor fears about the difference between the mad street people and ourselves. How far are we from losing all our money and our grace and ending up ranting on a corner, holding up a piece of cardboard over a cup? Each person who approaches a passerby on the street has his or her own story. He or she was brought low by a specific personal demon, be it economic, social, or otherwise. When you think this way, the conditions in the street become unbearable. You are in touch with the humanity of each individual and can't block his or her suffering out by blaming a global condition.
Elizabeth Suedos, reading from her family memoir, The Four of Us. Her brother Lincoln made his living on the street, playing his harmonica. He died in his shabby storefront apartment in 1989, shortly after he had been told he was being evicted. The building was going to be renovated. Friends tried to set him up in halfway houses, but he wouldn't go. He refused to leave his apartment, even after construction had begun. A shed was erected outside the storefront, blockading the entrance to his place. When Suedos realized he was still inside, she banged on the shed to get him to let her in, but he wouldn't respond. This was one of the many times he wouldn't let her help him. I asked what her frustrations were.
He was 8 years older than me, and I grew up worshiping him. He was my hero. I thought he was the most creative and funny guy that I'd ever met. He wore Madras Bermuda shorts and sunglasses, and he knew Tom Lehrer songs, and he could talk about Andy Warhol, and he sent me telegrams on my graduation about Bobby Kennedy, and he was, you know, he was really hip. He was a bopper, and I didn't know he was sick, really. So gradually, as I got into my late 20s, I began to realize that there was something really quite wrong with him. And he also began to not want to talk to me for reasons that seemed arbitrary, but that I'm sure in his thinking were quite logical. But he really just wanted me out of his life. And I tried to establish contact with him, and we did through the mail, some telephone calls and a lawyer. So by the time he reached this crisis point, we were in uneven but close contact. And I tried very hard to look for a place for him to move to. But unfortunately, he really rejected. It was the nature of his illness that he would reject a great deal of help from anyone. He'd accept it one day, reject it the next. When I was banging on that shed, I was banging on it knowing that he was falling a long, dark fall towards, if not death, then a very bad psychotic episode. Because if he was cutting himself off from the world, he was not being able to face the reality that he had to change his home. It was a very dark time.
You write in your book that the effects of mental illness became a dominating force in your home because no one could admit it existed. In fact, when your brother was diagnosed as schizophrenic and institutionalized, you weren't told about it. You were told, I think, that he went to college. What effect did it have on you to have that hidden from you?
I think it was probably one of the most negative forces in my psyche, because I had this adored person who one day went to college and never came home again. And what followed were really a series of strange and agitated conversations behind a closed door in my parents' bedroom, and strange phone calls to me late at night from a man who sounded like my brother, but who said he was a teacher from this place or a Vietnam vet or this or that. And over the years, there'd be telegrams or there'd be a cartoon that might come through the mail, but I never knew what happened to him. And finally, I was taken to New York to a private psychiatric hospital to visit him. And even then, he didn't admit it. I was taken in to meet his doctor. His doctor said nothing. Later on, when he became even worse and jumped in front of a subway and lost his arm and his leg, and my parents went to New York to spend a great deal of time with him, I was still told that it was just an accident, that there was nothing, you know, one could do. I went to visit him after that so-called accident, and he was behaving strangely, jumping up and down on like a rabbit on one foot and making sure that I saw what he looked like. And still I was told that he had had an accident, that he was eccentric, that he'd be getting employment soon, that he was writing a novel, that he was going to be maybe in a coffee house singing at the Café Wa. And I watched my mother become increasingly more remote and my father more agitated and angry, and I had not a clue.
You were pretty young. You were a teenager, I think, when your brother tried to kill himself by jumping in front of a train, an accident in which he lost an arm and a leg. Your mother tried to kill herself when you were young and then succeeded in taking her life years later. But you write in your book that when you were young, you had a romantic view of suicide, and that you saw self-destruction as a way of life that belonged to the gifted, the sensitive, and the poetically insane. And I think that that's something that a stage that a lot of young people go through, seeing self-destruction as being a sign of artistic giftedness. How did you outgrow that?
That's an interesting question.
I guess I ask that, you know, because a lot of people go through that stage, and what they know about that kind of what they know about it comes from reading biographies of the writers and artists that they most admire. But you saw it in your own family.
I think I outgrew it over a period of years, because I personally experienced devastating effects of my mother's suicide, the feeling of that she had checked out without ever wanting to know what happened to me, that she had left me without caring whether I had children or a career or a life, that my brother walked around maimed and cut me off when he felt like it, and drew me in when he felt like it. And I guess I began to see it as something so selfish, because in all of it, I disappeared. And I think that I didn't want to be a disappearing creature. I think I wanted to be a loved person who simply went through hard times with her loved ones and saw them through it, and not have people so involved in their darkness that they decide to leave the world. You see, once, as I began to get older and as I began to experience the loneliness that one feels when left behind, I no longer found what they did to be very romantic.
Composer and writer Elizabeth Suedos is my guest. Her new memoir about her family is called The Four of Us. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Composer and writer Elizabeth Suedos is my guest.
When you look back on your brother's life and death, do you think that in his last years he should have been institutionalized, that he would have been better off if he were?
I don't know. You know, it's a question that I think I've asked myself, not just about those years, but about 20 years of his life. I think it's a question that my father also fought with inside himself for many years. I mean, what does it mean to be institutionalized? Where are you sending someone? I don't know if that's the answer to a spirited soul such as my brother was. However, staying on the streets, he got himself into many, many fights. He was in danger. He didn't take care of himself. It's a terribly difficult question, and I think it points up how much thinking and work has to be done so that people who are psychotic are dealt with in a way that can help heal them rather than just keep them in a safe place, because I think that's degrading. So to answer your question, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know.
You know, there's a lot of research now about whether mental illness runs in families. Is there a genetic connection? And having both a mother and brother who suffered from this, do you worry about yourself?
Do I worry about myself? I have to sort of look at my life and say, well, there's a difference. I seem to be able to survive. The darkness that they left inside of me is undeniable. I don't think that I am genetically predisposed to hallucinations or delusions or flights from reality. And I think that I'm very lucky. And I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about that. I think I did when I was a younger woman. I'm a young woman now, but when I was a younger woman, I think I worried a whole lot that I would end up like my mother, depressed and in misery with the world and stuff. And so I kind of kept a record. Well, when she was 19, she was married. When I was 19, I won an OB. when she was 20, she had a baby that was going to ruin her life. When I was 20, I was in Europe. You know, I used to keep this like scoreboard, and it was like, you know, exhausting. I'm past the point now where I need to keep that scoreboard. The maintenance that I have to do, growing up in a family as I've depicted in The Four of Us, is to make my peace with them. And find joy in the world and find love in the world without paying tolls to them for their misery. It's called guilt, you know, the survivor guilt. So I deal with that.
So what do you do now each time you pass someone who's homeless? Do you often think about your brother? Do you often think, like so many of us think, well, how do I behave? What do I do?
I have a pretty good idea of how to behave around schizophrenic people when they're in a state of psychosis, which is that since I'm not a trained professional, nor am I in any way equipped to comfort them, I pretty much stay clear. I never see anyone on the street without thinking about my brother. A day never goes by where I don't think about my brother or my mother. I think that will probably be true for the rest of my life, or for my father, for that fact. I mean, just because he's okay, that I think we're all very deeply connected to our families. That's another point of the book, is regardless of what the family might be, they are there inside, and you have to make peace. A person on the street can often make me very angry. I want to say, why are you like that? You know, again, I keep asking the same question. Why do you have to be like that? What, you know, schizophrenic behavior can make me angry very quickly, regardless of the fact that I know it's involuntary. It's as involuntary as having cancer. But I still can be made very angry by it. And other times I'm very, very sad.
Composer and writer Elizabeth Suedos. Her new family memoir is called The Four of Us. This is Fresh Air.